You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
It's good to see so many of you here. We've got people outside the tent as well. I hope you can hear. Give me a wave if you can hear outside. Yeah, I only did that, so it makes me feel popular, so that's good. Thank you very much. My name's Dave. I'm Methodist Liaison Officer in Jerusalem, and it's a great pleasure to introduce this session. Greenbelt has a long, long history of talking about Palestine and Israel. It's a place where we allow a space to talk about difficult issues, to recognize the gross injustice that exists in the Holy Land. And we have been doing it for 40 years. And many people in this tent and many people who have been at those green belts have started a journey to discover what life is actually like for Palestinians, what life is actually like in the land that we still call holy. It's a proud tradition we have as Greenbelt, and we will continue that. We will continue it until there is no injustice. We will continue it until Palestine is free. But we also live in a time when there are difficult legislation, difficult and tricky conversations to be had. Last year, as this year, we are living when an organization, Palestine Action, is a proscribed terrorist organization. We may or may not agree with that, but we need to respect that that is the law of this land for two reasons. One, we need to protect the reputation of Greenbelt, but also we need to protect those wonderful speakers that we have from Palestine who come and share this stage with us. So I'm saying this to ask you, when we get to the questions, please, let's not ask questions about Palestine Action. Please not ask questions that could tarnish the reputation of Greenbelt or with the endanger the reputation of our speakers. Instead, let us continue to have this in-depth conversation with deep listening to hear the lived experience of oppression and actually challenge ourselves to change things perhaps in this country, but also change things in Palestine and in Israel. I'm sure you understand. I know you understand because I know what Greenbelters are like. So thank you very much indeed. I'm now going to introduce Sue from Embrace, who I can't see. There she is, who's going to actually introduce the session. Sue.
Good morning. It's so lovely to see you all here. Thank you for being here. And on behalf of Embrace the Middle East and Coventry Cathedral, it is my absolute privilege to welcome you to Pagoda for speaking truth and seeking justice, remembering apartheid, hearing Palestine. Thank you so much for being here. Now, this morning's conversation brings together voices shaped by different places and experiences, yet connected by a commitment to truthfulness, advocacy, and dignity. We are joined by Mohamed Al-Kaizi from the Dahesha refugee camp in Bethlehem. He is also the director of the Olive Tree campaign. We're joined by Daniel Manaya from Jerusalem, who is the director of Musahala, and Lama Mansour from Nazareth, who is a sociologist particularly interested in researching the impact of life in Israel for Palestinians who live within Israel's borders. And they are going to be in conversation with Canon Natano Muller of Coventry Cathedral, whose life and ministry have been shaped by South Africa's struggle against apartheid and the very long journey that followed. As we listen, it's important to remember that Palestinian experience is not one story, but many. The intentional fracturing of Palestinian society means that even our three Palestinian speakers live under different legal, social, and political realities. Their identities determine where they can travel and where they can live. Despite sharing a peoplehood and a history, trying to gather in the same place in their own country is sometimes impossible and never straightforward. We will hear about the extraordinary realities hidden within daily life, about what it means to live under systems of control that shape not only movement, but opportunity, relationships, imagination, and belonging. We'll reflect on the impact of settler colonialism, not as an abstract concept, but as something that reaches into homes, communities, and futures. Now, at the same time, this conversation will resist the temptation to rush towards easy solutions. As Daniel often reminds us, the deeper question is how we engage in ways that are genuinely empowering, how we listen ethically, act faithfully, and how we relate to our neighbours, even those with whom we profoundly disagree. Netano's experience of South Africa reminds us that while political systems can be dismantled, the dismantling of hearts and minds takes much, much longer. Reconciliation is never simply a political project. It's also a human and a spiritual one. Amid all that is painful, there remains remarkable courage and creativity in each one of our speakers. We will hear of their inspiring work taking place on the ground, often unseen, as people continue to seek justice and imagine a different future. Later on, do come and visit us on the Embrace stand to find out more about each of our remarkable speakers and also find out how you can twin your tree with a tree, an olive tree in Palestine. We're invited to listen carefully, hold space for complexity. This is not only an opportunity to learn from our panelists, but to reflect on what faithful truth-telling and justice-seeking might require of each and every one of us. There will, of course, be an opportunity for questions. So will you join me in welcoming our panelists?
Good morning, everyone. It's an absolute delight to be with you this morning. Thank you, Sue, for that wonderful introduction. I must admit, my future boss is sitting in the audience this morning, our new dean. But I must say, I'm a green belt, a virgin. So this is my my debut on the green belt stage. Thank you. Thank you very much. But thank you so much to Embrace for enabling, Embrace the Middle East, for enabling this conversation to take place. A very important and timely conversation, which I'm hoping we'll invite all of you into as well a little bit later on. By way of introduction, which there are lots of this morning, but by way of introduction and for the centering of the Palestinian voices with us this morning, I'll invite myself and them to just share a little bit about themselves, their work, and where they come from. So as you heard, I'm Netano Miller. I like to self-describe as ontologically Black African. I'm existentially queer, and I'm spiritually Christian. So that's what I bring into this space. Also a juggler of books and chalices and a social life as a millennial priest. The locus of my ministry and my work is at, as you heard, Coventry Cathedral, where I serve as a residential canon. I look after worship and welcome, the fanciest job title in the Church of England. I was born and raised in South Africa, particularly Cape Town, the Cape Flats, in the late 80s. You can tell, obviously, by my young face, early 90s. And my experience of South Africa was formed in the volatile years of transition as South Africa was moving from the apartheid system, as we understood it, to what was coined the Rainbow Nation, the Free South Africa. Lots of comments can be made about that, and I'm hoping you'd ask me questions a little bit later on. But that certainly shaped how I've come into the church as someone framed through the lens of liberation theology. So apartheid and the 400 years of colonial legacy that existed before then is certainly what has shaped my lens here today. So I'm deeply honored to share the stage and the space with three incredible human beings who bring all of who they are into this space. And so I am going to ask them one question as a starter for 10, and I'm going to invite them to take us on a journey. My friends, Suze reminded us that the Palestinian experience is not a single experience. Could each of you tell us something about the place you call home that you wish people outside of Palestine to understand? I'm going to start with you, Lama, if that's okay.
Good morning, Greenbelt. Sabah al-khair. As was said, my name is Lama Mansour. I grew up in Nazareth in Galilee. You might know a famous person from there. And yes, good can come out of Nazareth. I grew up in Nazareth, but I'm now based in Jerusalem. I work as a researcher, as was said before, focusing on the realities of young people, young Palestinians living in contexts of violence and oppression. And one thing I wish people knew is, I think what you started with, the fracturing, the intentional fracturing of Palestinians across the land. What my research focuses on is Palestinians who live inside of Israel. You might hear us in the news being referred to as Arab Israelis. That is not something that we accept mostly as a community. That is not a label that we take on lightly. What we would rather be called is Palestinian citizens of Israel. And that means that in 1948, during the Nakba, during the establishment of the State of Israel and the catastrophe of the Palestinians, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, both sets of my grandparents were able to stay in the borders of what became Israel and then received its citizenship, were forced to take on its citizenship. And so that means that while my heritage, my identity is very much Palestinian, I am a citizen of Israel. And that raises questions of identity, of belonging, of recognition, of acknowledgement. And so that complexity and that fracturing of the Palestinians across the land is one thing that I wish people understood about the realities across the land today.
Good morning. Thank you for coming. Yeah, I think it's my fourth time here in Greenbelt, so I'm used to this.
Veteran.
Yeah. So my name is Muhannad. About where I live and what I live, I think I live in a refugee camp, but there is another place live in me, which is my original village. So it's different. I was born and grew up in a refugee camp in Bethlehem. But originally, we come from a village called Beit Jibrin. In 1948, my family were forced to leave or to displaced from there. So all my life, I am listening about that place that I never saw and that lives inside me, because I wish one day to go back and to explore and to discover or to live there, you know. But growing up in a refugee camp is very hard. I mean, I still live in a refugee camp, and the refugee camps, there is some in Palestine, some of them in Gaza, some in Syria, and Lebanon, and Jordan. So Palestinians are living inside and outside as refugees. We are talking about millions of people. Of course, we are refugees because some other people came to take our land and live and enjoy, you know, the privilege of the space and the green and the beautiful nature of Palestine. And we were squeezed in the refugee camp. And if you ask me what I wish the people to understand is to live around fences, because when I was born in 1988, The first memory of me for until 1995 is the fence in the front of our house and the rolling gate. And I am now 38, and I still witness fences and walls and restrictions and gates, and it gets worse and worse. And the freedom of movement that maybe you don't, a lot of people, they don't appreciate it, around. It's one of the most things that Palestinians are suffering from, because we are divided. I can't visit Daniel in Jerusalem. I never been to Nazareth, in the north. If I want to travel abroad, it's a lot of procedures. I need visas. And now among the West Bank, if I want to travel from a place to another, it's very hard for us. I mean, you live under occupation, but sometimes things stops you. Mm. Like during this summer, we went to some occasions outside Bethlehem. And most of the villages and towns where we went to, we had to park the car outside and cross a gate, and then another car come to pick us up and then walk. And in the same spot where you're crossing the gate, you see settlers on the highway, driving very fast and enjoying a very beautiful road. And I think that's the apartheid, one of the forms that we see, that I am a human, he's enjoying beautiful road. Me and my mom have to cross gates and the gun is pointed at us all of the time. And that's the daily life of us. Wow. More fences, more walls, more checkpoints, yeah. More harassment of the people, and the way how they look at us, they don't see as human as anyone else, and they see that we are deserving what happened to us, and that makes us feel very frustrated and disappointed and sad in a way.
Thank you, my brother. Thank you very much for sharing that so powerfully. Daniel?
Yeah, good morning, everyone. I'm from Jerusalem, but I'm a mixed breed. I'm half British and half Palestinian, but I grew up in Jerusalem for the most of my life. So I am also a proud Palestinian to be a Bolton Wanderers supporter. We might be the only Bolton Wanderers Palestinian supporters. So I grew up in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is a city that is very much politically tense. There's segregation. The East Jerusalemites do not enjoy also the same rights and privileges as the Palestinians who are citizens of Israel. I am, though, a Palestinian citizen of Israel because my family is originally from the coast. We're not originally from from. Oops.
Sorry.
Powerful speech.
Here we go. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, we're from the coast, from Jaffa, Yaffa, and Lydd. That's where my grandmother and grandfather come from, and then my mother and father met in Jaffa. My mom went as a missionary to Jaffa and met my dad, and they're still married and like to go on walks together. So that's really nice. I'm the executive director of Musalaha, which means reconciliation in Arabic, and we wrestle and struggle with the commandment to love one's enemy and to love one's neighbor. How do we do it while we have extreme oppression? You heard from Muhannad what's going on, and how do we do that in a way that's not abusive to the weaker power? Mm. How do we do that in a way that ensures that we safeguard the humanity of those who are joining our spaces? There's two things I'd like you to know, and I'm sure many of you do already know. The first is that the situation in Gaza, which is not represented today here, continues to be extremely awful. The infrastructure that sustained a culture and a people has been destroyed. So we have now people for months living in rubble and still being bombed. They were bombed yesterday. So it's I don't want us to assume or think that the sense of urgency should go away for the people that live there. The second thing I'd like to share is that there is a huge exodus of Palestinians leaving Palestine. Mm. Not only, but also, and you could say more of Christians. And that presents a serious challenge to us. Just in the team that I am leading, we had two people leave last year, and we had 9 participants who decided to leave from the 8 programs that we have. So we are not coming here to talk to you just about a cause. We're talking to you about an existential threat that we are facing as a people and also as sub-communities within Palestine.
Can we please put our hands together for our panel? I shudder when I hear the stories of the Palestinian people because it reminds me so much of the story of my people back home, the age-old tactic of divide and conquer, the fracturing of a people and a nation. Back in South Africa, people would have been, after the introduction of apartheid as an actual system in the 1940s, 1950s, the Bantustans were created, communities where black people were designated to go and live and work, and to exit those communities, they needed to carry what was called the dom pass. Literally means a stupid pass. For any black person who wanted to move outside of that immediate vicinity, particularly because black people were the workforce that were relied upon, and so they'd need to move into white communities to go and work as domestics and carers and so on and so forth. And so hearing particularly Muhammad's depiction of life as a refugee in his community is something that, I mean, I'm borderlining tears, because for goodness sake, in 2026, that this continues to exist and happen just burns within me as a South African, which is probably why we took a particular nation to the country, to the International Criminal Court. It just brings something up within me at a very personal level. Because Mohanad and Daniel and Lama, you are our siblings, you are us, and we are you. And so you living in this experience is unfair and unjust. Mohanad, I want to lean into your description just ever so slightly. The word refugee is meant to be a temporary status. A refugee camp is meant to be a temporary thing that refugees go to live for a while. What does that mean for you now as someone who's been there all your life?
Yeah, I mean, there is two things here. Is that the experience we had since 78 years now is very tough for the people. I mean, my family, they used to be rich family, farming family, extended family, living in a very beautiful place. In one night, they became below zero, and they started from the scratch, living in a tent. I mean, here you can't even stand 2 or 3 days in a tent, but my family lived. Yeah. Mm. I mean, when I come here, I want to live in a tent, because it's not because of the nature or the camping, but I want to see what my grandparents also experience, you know, the water issue, the cold, the sun, like all these problems. I mean, I saw my grandma, she used to go all the way to bring the water from somewhere, you know, carry like the water and come back. My mom did that. The school system, it's very crowded. It's a horrible, you know, like experience to be a refugee. But we are still lucky with all this because we still live in Palestine. Others who live in Syria and Lebanon and Jordan, they have even harder, you know, this situation. And we thought it would be temporary. That's why we carry the key with us. And then we came to the refugee camp.
Yes.
And, you know, we have gone through the experience, and we got education, we improved our life, but we always know that this should be temporary. Especially there is a UN resolution 194 which says all the Palestinian refugees has the right to go back, but unfortunately no one is helping us to implement our rights of going back. And what scares me is not only how we are witnessing and experiencing the life under occupation in the refugee camps. It always have been targeted by the Israelis because of the movement inside. But now the whole West Bank is living the 10 years before the Nakba again. So we are in the level where the Israelis now occupying the West Bank and building a network of bypass roads for them and taking the lands from the Palestinians. And before, you used to have a settlement and surrounded by a fence. Now I think it's the stage where they will flip the fence against the Palestinians and we will be living in an isolated, you know, big camp like Gaza, and they will enjoy all the lands in the West Bank. And I mean, Area C is about 62% you know, of the West Bank, and they are planning to take all Area C and convert it for settlements and cities, modern cities, for the Israelis. So I am more afraid, like all what I have experienced, I am coping with it, I am struggling with it, but now what's coming after is the apartheid and the more discrimination against Palestinians, because that's what we are witnessing these days. If you want, if you need me to tell me you about Dehesha, you know, where I live, raids 3 or 4 times, you know, every week.
Gosh.
They come, tear gas, shooting, arresting people. Right now, there is about 7,000 or 8,000 Palestinians are in jail, women, children, you know, elderly and young people being tortured and coming out to the camp, closing of all the organizations that we used to go to. So you don't feel safe in your bed, and that's one of the main problems. Like, you don't feel safe.
Yes.
Yesterday, there was a thunder, like a something boom for the rain. And I wake up, and I have to tell myself, this is not a sound bomb. You are in the UK. Just get back to sleep.
Yeah.
And then I enjoyed the rain. But I have to tell myself, like, to say it. Like, chill. There is nothing wrong happening. You are in the UK. So it took me, you know, maybe 10 seconds to understand where I am. And that's the trauma that we have, you know, of living in this situation.
Yeah.
And before it used to be only for the refugee camps, but now the whole city of Bethlehem under this situation, settlers are coming closer and, you know, closing the roads and closing all the exits, so we are not able to move. I mean, I never witnessed Palestine like this past 2 years, you know. 1 year after the war, they are just taking the lands and they are not dealing with us.
Yes.
In any humanitarian, like in any human way. And that's scary. And if we compare it a little bit, you know, with South Africa, I went to South Africa to learn about, you know, their struggle. And I was shocked when my South African friends, they told me, you have worse situation than what we had.
Absolutely.
And then that made me think about what used to happen. Like, I went to Robben Island. I read about Nelson Mandela. And, you know, Nelson Mandela is very famous for his struggle, of course, and the years that he spent in jail. But 45 years in the Israeli jail, that's a normal, regular number. Like, people not shocked when they say, 40 is not like... Because people spent 45 and 48
Absolutely.
Years in one time in the Israeli jails.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we are in 2026 and people are witnessing this.
In real time,
And that's fine. Just the last thing about this and mentioning Gaza. And I want you to think about this. In Gaza, when there was the starvation period of time, so children, they don't find milk or water, and they were dying because of this. A German association for animals, they saw some donkeys there starving. So they asked to rescue the donkeys, and they rescued 8 donkeys from Gaza to Germany. And they were just making sure the donkeys are good. So when you look at us as less than human, like animals, you know, and the animals are more important, you are shocked of this.
Absolutely.
And that's why when we come here and you listen to us, we feel good.
Yes.
Because it supports us that there is some people still care.
Mm.
So in general, what's happening in Palestine is really...
It's evil.
Like beyond imagination these days. I think it's tough. And the worst is still to come. And that's why we need the people's action with
that's
us
right.
more.
That's right. Thanks, Manad. Thank you. Thank you for... I said to the three of them on whenever we met in the week, I said I should take my shoes off in their presence because they embody a sense of resilience that is needed in the world today. And sorry that you need to be resilient. but you exemplify a way of being that I think is an example to all of us, certainly in this room, but to the whole world, as a way of being, a way of being steadfast in and resolute in yourself. Lama, I want to invite you to just talk to us a little bit about your research, particularly amongst young people, and help us understand what that dehumanization looks like and feels like for the young people on the ground, particularly as someone yourself who has lived experience as a Palestinian living in Israel.
Yeah, I just want to address kind of the resilience point.
Yes.
And actually, I woke up this morning and taught a class on Zoom, and it was on resilience.
Wow.
With
wow.
the teachers.
Wow.
Mostly from Jerusalem. Mm. And it's something that we have to think about as a community and cultivate as a
yes.
community. My nuance would be when we're outside of our own communities, mm. is don't take our resilience as an excuse for inaction.
Yes. Yes.
And don't romanticize it. Mm. Our friends in Gaza say we're not legends. Like, we're not mythical creatures who can withstand everything. Mm. So the fact that people can have hope and creativity and withstand difficult situations does not mean that this is an excuse for inaction. Mm. And I just want to kind of put a point Amen. In that. Mm. Research. Yes, so I'll kind of connect it to the... I mentioned earlier the fact that sometimes we're named Arab Israelis, and that's part of Israel's strategy to take away the Palestinian component of our identity, to separate us from our people. Mm. On the other hand, when Israel will have elections soon, and you will hear on the news... Yes, there are 2 million Arabs in Israel, and they can vote, and they can, and we're used, our existence as a community is used to whitewash Israel as an apartheid state. So there is no apartheid because Arabs can vote, because Palestinians, they won't use the word Palestinians, but can vote, those 2 million who have citizenship, and can work in hospitals, and can go to universities, and all of that. And so you'll hear it. And it makes me so angry that our stories, our existence, our just going on about our daily lives is used in this way to discredit the oppression of our brothers and sisters elsewhere. With young people, it is... I want to connect to the point that Daniel was making in a lot of the work that we do, this crisis of identity, this push and pull factors, this oppression, what we are hearing from young people is a lot of people want to leave. Mm. And a lot of people can't handle it anymore. Mm. Or just want a better life. Mm. It's not that they don't love the land. It's not that they don't love their families. It's not that they don't want to contribute to society. But there's very little horizon for any possibilities. Mm. In the last 3 years, as Palestinians inside Israel, ever since the war on Gaza began, we have been completely unable to speak out. Not completely, but the first few months were very, very. You couldn't go out to protest. Some of my friends were being rounded up and arrested because of things they posted on social media. I have to be very careful about what we say. Like, the threat is always there. And so that, alongside with the economic situation, alongside the political situation, the social situation, I mean, Nazareth, there's no place for people to expand. It's grown fivefold since 1948, but it's remained in the same area. So you can imagine how people are kind of on top of each other. Young people can't find housing, employment, and so on. And so the oppression looks different across the land, but it's the same tactics.
Right.
And what we're hearing from young people is that there's very little horizon for a future in the land.
Mm. Thanks, Lama. I mean, that is such an important point to make, because if our young people are hopeless, there's not much to be hopeful about and for. And I know certainly since my arrival in the UK, we've often had conversations, and this is me making a connection with you, Daniel. Our speed and the haste with which we want to talk about solutions, and you know, we want to solve this problem so that we can all feel better about ourselves and get on with our daily lives. For you, Daniel, as someone who works in this messy world of reconciliation, and it's almost a dirty word, isn't it? When we say it in English, but in your language, it lands probably better because it has so much more nuance. But Daniel, talk to us about neutrality versus reconciliation, and this and our need for wanting to run to solutions. Help us think that through a little bit.
Thank you, Antano. Before I jump into neutrality and reconciliation, I'd like to build on the point that Lama was making, that we all as Palestinians are experiencing different forms of oppression, but they come from the same root. And Lama said it's similar tactics. This is true. And I think we have to name exactly what we are dealing with in order to understand what were we talking about when we're talking about reconciliation. So when we talk about these terms, apartheid, occupation, genocide, what do many of these terms mean? And many times people get hung up on the word, but these words are a vocabulary attempt to explain what we are experiencing as humans. And the framework in which we are all living in is what we call a settler colonial project, a settler colonial state. We understand, or I understand, Israel as a settler colonial project. And a settler colonial project is Europeans who move to another land and want to build a new Europe at the expense of the indigenous people that already live there, which is different than the extraction colonial mechanism, which is Great Britain going to India and stealing $35 trillion over the time that Great Britain was there. It's different. This is where people go and permanently reside on this new land. So the primary concern of settler colonial projects is land. And another goal of settler colonial projects is to eliminate the native population. And it is done through not an event, but through a mechanism. And it's a mechanism that takes the settlers, the European settlers, and keeps them on top, and ensures that the native population stays at the bottom. Now, when we talk about apartheid, what do we mean? Apartheid, we mean two different systems for two different people based on their ethnicity, religious, racial background. So we need to understand apartheid as an expression of settler colonialism, because apartheid helps achieve settler colonial objectives. One of the objectives that it fulfills for the settler colonial project is segregation and isolation. And then once you isolate and segregate and fragment the Palestinians into these smaller groups, and you isolate Gaza for almost two decades, that allows for the possibility of genocide. So genocide as the attempt to wipe out a part or a whole group of people. So we need to understand first that we're not talking about Gaza separate, genocide, apartheid separate, West Bank, discrimination and racism neglect of the Palestinians that live inside Israel. These are all coming from the same root of settler colonialism, which is to eliminate the native population. Now, there's different ways to eliminate the native population. It can be through mass extermination, genocide, as we're seeing in Gaza. But it can also look like more subtle ways, which is what Lama is saying, even changing our name from Palestinian to just Arab. So there are different ways, and for me it's important that you understand these connections, that Gaza is not just Gaza, that what's happening in the West Bank is not just separate and different. They're all manifestations of settler colonialism. And many of the genocides that we have recorded in history are from settler colonial projects, have happened in Canada, the United States, Australia, right? New Zealand, and we can go on and on and on. So first and foremost, we have to understand that we're living in a context in which there are different ways to eliminate the native, and there are different mechanisms or tools that the state uses in order to do that. And this is not only in Israel-Palestine. This is a global ecosystem mechanism that has allowed this to happen. And we can get into it more, but the United Kingdom, yes, and the United States and Germany are a part of this. They have participated in this, allowing this to happen. Israel could not do this on its own. So first, I want to frame correctly what we're dealing with. Now, after I've shared with you everything I've just told you, does it make sense for me to come to my fellow Palestinians living in the different contexts of oppression and tell them, join a reconciliation program that's neutral? Reconciliation has to be honest, and it has to face the death, the destruction, the pain, the oppression, in order for it to be relevant to the people. So neutrality is usually presented by the powerful and dominant group in order to pacify, submit, and neutralize the actual essence and meaning of reconciliation, which is restoring broken relationships between people.
Yes.
But how are you going to restore relationships between people when one group is occupying, dominating, and genociding another? It has to be addressed. It has to be brought to the center of the conversation. It has to require a reconciliation in order for it to be authentic. It has to center Palestinian humanity. And if you don't understand Palestinians' need for freedom, you haven't understood our humanity. So that's why reconciliation cannot be neutral, and reconciliation initiatives that are neutral are dangerous.
Yes.
And they solidify and cement and work for the settler colonial project itself.
Thanks, Daniel. Thank you very much.
I think we could sit here all day, but we're going to shift. I mean, that's a lovely segue to turn the mirror, as it were, towards all of us who are gathered here this afternoon and to say to ourselves, what work do I need to do? What do I need to do as I'm seated here this afternoon? We have a time now for questions, and we are going to, I see you, sir, and I see you, ma'am, at the back. Yes, I see you. And one more, possibly, from the side. Thank you. I'm going to ask you, we have a roving mic. You can pose your question. Please say, remember, we're not making statements. We are asking questions. I was a teacher in my former life.
Question mark.
Thank you so much, sir. Please.
Hi, my name is Martin. I worked in South Africa in the 80s. I went to South Africa, so I understand elements of apartheid, although I've got white privilege. In terms of, well, I wear a Palestinian band here that says no to apartheid that I got from some of my Muslim friends. Should we put together the same boycott of Israel as was put on South Africa in the 1980s to turn the money off?
Yes. Thank you so much. Was that directed at a particular person or? Go for it. Since we're centering your voices, please.
Yeah. So if we are talking about the two systems, I believe that the boycott worked very well in the South African concept. And for the Palestinian cause, I think it's one of the strongest ways how we can, at least from your side, you know, abroad, to do toward Israel, to boycott. At least, like, we all know in this room or in this tent that most of the weapons that used against the children in Gaza to kill the children, financed by America and by the UK. And there is many companies that it's right there in London, you know, supporting and selling all these arms to the Israelis. I mean, before, like behind the boycott, there is many meanings of it. Solidarity, when you just go to the market and you don't buy, you know, goods from the settlement or hummus, but also there is like the cultural, there is like the economy. And right before the war, you know, the economy of Israel, you know, was really impacted by the boycott and divestment, you know, like campaign. Omar Barghouti is coming here, and he will be explaining about how important to use the boycott as a method, you know, to stand with Palestinians. And I think it's something morally to boycott this regime. And I know that recently there is more than 250,000 people left from Israel. Most of them are doctors and professors because they don't want to live in this system anymore. They don't want to raise their children in that system. So boycott sometimes is not only to hurt or to impact, but also to shake this community and to tell them, I am not dealing with you because you are killing children. Because Israel now forgot where they are going, like as a state. Like some people that I know boycott Israel because they love Israel. Because they want to remind them, like, what you're doing is wrong, and they will not stand with you for what you are doing. And our position is that the Holy Land is welcome for the Jewish, welcome for the Christian, and for the Muslim. Like, no one in Palestine would say, this is mine as a Muslim or a Christian. Like, everyone should come and welcome to come to live. And that's the idea when we welcomed the Jewish people from Europe in 1930 and 40 and 50. Because we believe it's a holy land and everyone has the right to come and to live. But you are not allowed to kill the people and to do genocide and then to deal with you as if you are normal, you know, entity or country. So boycott is one of the best ways that you can take as international communities, you know, toward Israel, not only economic, but morally, you know, to boycott this system. And I am sure it will make impact.
Thanks, Mohan. Thank you. Thank you very much for the question. Daniel also has a response. Before we go to our second question, Daniel has a response.
Just very quickly, a settler colonial project has to have ascending power. The sending power of Israel used to be Great Britain, and then the United States took on that role from Great Britain. So a settler colonial project cannot be dismantled without also closing the tap on the sending power that enforces it. So I don't believe that our situation back home can change without external pressure coming from the outside.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to ask a question about hope in the midst of devastation. I've just finished reading A.L. Weisman's book, Ungrounding, which is the most extraordinary and intimate narration of the fact that the means of warfare are also removing the conditions of life, the fertility of the land, etc. But I wondered what each of you hold on to, either in terms of your memory or something that you can still see that allows you to imagine that it could be rebuilt.
Thank you. I'm going to invite Lama to answer that because I think that's right up your alley.
Thank you for that. I was waiting for that question because it comes usually in events. We're asked about our hope. And I want to reemphasize the same point about resilience, is we shouldn't romanticize the hope of Palestinians. No. And sometimes when I'm asked that question, I want to say to people, I want you to give me hope. Because as Daniel closed, many times we feel like, I feel like decisions that are made in our land are more impacted by what happens here than what happens back home. So I want to start by saying, I want you to give me hope. And I want the international community to give me hope. My hope as a Palestinian Christian comes from my faith and from history. I'll start with history. Empires don't last. eventually they get too arrogant and they fall. That's one reason to hope. And we've seen from our friends and struggles elsewhere in South Africa, for one, is that progress can be made, even though it's partial. So that gives me hope. And then my faith in God, I'm now based in Jerusalem, and I'm often reminded that Jerusalem is the city of the resurrection. So our Friday and Saturday might be very, very long, but we live in the land of the resurrection. And we live in the land of the impossible resurrection. And so that gives me hope. And because of the resurrection, we're invited as Christians, as people of faith, to live out that resurrection. It's not just something that we believe in, it's something that we do. And so every time that we... For me, in my work, every time I have a conversation with a young person, or every time that I write, or every time that I come to a place like here, I think that we're building the kingdom in the small acts that we do. And that kingdom is eternal. Absolutely. So empires come and go, but the kingdom of God remains. And that's what we're invited to build alongside God as partners. We're not just waiting for, you know, for heaven or for the world to come. We're active. And so Mitri Rahib, one of the Palestinian theologians, says hope is what we do. Yes. And as Palestinians, hope is what we do.
Thank you.
Hope. Yeah, I would also add a warning. I've talked about it a few times, but there's a tend to consume hope. And I'd encourage people not to consume hope from the identities that we wish to hear hope from. But similar to Lama, I also believe in the resurrection. And I witness that the Palestinian people as a whole have a spirit that a tank cannot fight. I'm not here to say that we're not suffering and we're not in pain. We 100% are, but hope has to face that suffering and pain. And I get inspired by the fellow Palestinians that I live with, and their resilience and the spirit that they have coming from within to continue to resist. So my hope is in the cross and resurrection. And I actually think that I've never had more moral clarity ever before in my life. Because when you are on the losing side, and when we as Palestinians are losers, we actually, I think, can understand the cross more correctly. Because the cross is a symbol of defeat and failure. Maybe not today, it's become a holy symbol, but it was the last say of the Roman Empire over those who decided to rebel. And the resurrection says that they don't have the last say. And I am not coming and approaching and behaving in this life as if I'm going to be a winner. I accept losing, and I accept that losing is the way of the cross. And I think that's why it sometimes can be so difficult to understand the cross in the UK. Not understand the cross in the sense of what is the cross and that Jesus died on it. I'm talking about the cross in terms of resistance to oppression and violence and empire and religious establishment, what it represented at the time. The hope is coming from the fact that I believe that I can have this clarity and understand that in the faith, I find the ability to resist. And I have the hope that the final say won't be death.
Amen.
That the final say is life. And that is the same motivation that wakes me up every day and makes me choose life. And in my case, not violence. Mm. I'm not here to judge and say anything about anyone else, but I'm speaking specifically for me. This is what holds me and inspires me to continue moving forward. So hope is not an optimism, a cheap optimism of let's feel good. It's actually hope comes from a terrible place. And I'd like us, you know, to think about that maybe together and, sure. And sorry.
No, it's fine. They are here for the rest of today and tomorrow. So you'll have lots of time to talk to them. I'm going to just, you okay? Okay, okay. Our final question.
Is that me? Yeah. Hello. It's difficult to follow that with this question, but I'd like to ask your view on how you feel about the argument that our government imposing sanctions, threatening to impose sanctions, is more powerful than imposing them because the threat still gives you some influence. Once they're imposed, if they're ignored, it makes no difference. And I'm just wondering how to talk to my MP about this.
Me? I don't know. I don't know how you need to talk to your MP. I don't know your MP, and I don't know where you live, and I don't know what he cares about or she cares about. Or what makes people in the UK tick. So I would suggest that people in the UK get together and ask those questions and brainstorm and have sessions in which they say, how can we most effectively communicate with our MPs? We have a lot going on back home. And unfortunately, I don't have the capacity to, I would have loved to have, but I don't have the capacity to think of how do we reach MPs in the UK and how do we reach senators and congressmen in the US. This is why it has to be a global movement against oppression, against the violence of empires and political powers that misuse it. So I would throw the question back to you. If there are ways that we can help you reach your MP and communicate effectively and help that message, I think we'd be open to do that, but I don't have the answer in terms of the solution for that.
Which, like every good sermon, ends on a question. So it's right back at you. Right back at you. My friends, join me in thanking our panelists who have been incredible this afternoon.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.